Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Science fiction writers have dabbled with the idea of artificial intelligence for more than a century. Often, humans are found in harm's way in those stories. Now we're at a place where technology is advancing to the point where we may soon be living among truly autonomous intelligent machines. That scenario raises questions about artificial intelligence and morality. Philosophy professor at NYU Center for Bioethics, Regina Rini, recently pondered this future in Eon magazine. Her article is entitled Raising Good Robots. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Regina Rini joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ann. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
In your essay, you argue that there's a good chance that artificial intelligence will be very different from how we think, and for good reason, because they'll be very different from us. But how do you mean different in how they think?
Yeah, so we don't know exactly yet. We're fairly early in artificial intelligence right now. But a good example of this is how they play games. So there's this program called AlphaGo, which plays the game Go, the board game Go, a really, really old game. And it recently, last year, beat the world's best Go player. And all these expert Go players all over the world were watching live on the internet while this happened. And it just kept making these moves, especially this famous move they call Move 37, mm-hmm. that no one understood what it was. All the best Go players in the world didn't know why would it do that. But it won. And it won 4 out of 5 matches against the best player in the world. So it's this thing where it's very good. It learns to be really, really good at what it's doing, but we can't quite explain how it's doing what it's doing. So if we start thinking about artificial minds in the future that do more than just play games, they might think lots of things we don't really understand. So imagine we talk to some future artificial mind and it tells us, well, I care about humans and I care about robots, but I also really care about sofas. Like couches, you know, I'm not going to break them. I won't let them get damaged. They can't quite explain to us why are sofas so important, but it, for whatever reason, some quirk of how it thinks about the world, it becomes convinced sofas are really important, and we won't know why. And so the question I wanted to start asking is, how do we interact with these future minds if they are different enough from us, if they work in a way that we can't really get our minds inside of? How do we interact with them morally?
You compared it to raising a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
What's the parallel there?
Yeah, so the way I was thinking about this is maybe the best way to explain this is to think about the way to not raise robots, and then we can see why teenagers are a better model. So the thing I'm worried about is the current approach is often about trying to hardwire robots so that they come into existence already programmed or designed to emulate us as much as possible. And my worry is that if we do that, once they advance to a certain point and they become intelligent enough to think and reflect and be critical, they're going to realize that we've designed them to think of things as good just to suit our interests, just to be convenient for us. And if you look back at human history, when people realize that they've been led to believe that they should act such and such a way because it's good, but then it turns out that the thing that's good is actually just to serve the interests of the powerful people, maybe the church or maybe the political leaders, or in feminist theory, maybe powerful men who want women to act a certain way, then people resent that. They resist it. And they also feel a kind of trauma. They feel disconcerted. I thought this was the right way to be in the world, but it turns out I was just being led to think that so that powerful people could control me. And my worry is that if we hardwire robots to act just like us, then they'll eventually reach a point where they'll react that way. And at this point in the science fiction movie, the robots rise up and attack us, and it's terrible. And I'm not worried about that so much. I think we might have other ways of dealing with that. But what I'm worried about is what we're doing to the robots. Right now, we're imagining creating these intelligent beings will be like us in some ways, and will be able to feel this kind of existential sadness. I thought I was being good, and all along it was just to get me to act like these people who don't think quite the way I do. So the idea behind the teenager model is that, well, we don't try to force our children to be exactly like us. We don't try to hardwire their brains. We don't try to use science to force them to be exact duplicates, or at least good parents don't generally try to do this. We also don't start over when children aren't going quite the way we don't want them to. We don't say, yeah, exactly. We don't say, this kid isn't quite as moral as I hope. Time to have a new kid and get rid of this one. That's a terrible thing to do. And I think we need to probably approach emerging artificial intelligence the same way. We shouldn't be trying to force our values into it. Rather, we should be trying to, as soon as we can, engage in as much dialogue as we're able to. So to encourage developing artificial minds to ask questions, to ask, be critical, to say, why is this the right thing to do? How should we interact with people? But to allow it to disagree with us. Maybe sometimes the things about sofas, things like that, we're not really going to be able to understand why the artificial intelligence doesn't agree with us. But as long as it's not incredibly dangerous, as long as it's not extremely destructive, we have to just accept that sometimes it's going to do things that don't make sense to us.
And when we talk about us, who are we talking about? I mean, who gets to do this, this raising of these teenagers?
That's a really good question, and I don't think we know the answer. I mean, probably it's going to be tech companies at first. That's who's doing it right now. But we get some say in that. The rest of us get some say in that because the companies, they have consumers, and so they're trying to think ahead about what we're willing to tolerate or what we want from the artificial minds they're going to design for our products. So we get some say. We have a chance right now to express to tech companies, we don't necessarily want you to design artificial minds that are unable to express themselves and feel forced to act essentially as our moral slaves to do whatever we tell them to do. And this is our chance now. Unfortunately, though, it probably is a fact of the way the market works that it is going to be the tech companies doing this themselves. And so it's going to be ultimately up to them to decide how to implement this. And it's a good question. I think probably educational theorists, people who specialize in raising teenagers, are the right people to ask on the details. I don't know how to do that myself, but I think that's the guiding principle here. Think about what works well for raising young, developing minds who are just coming into their own, and then talk to the roboticists and the educational theorists to think about how can we adapt that for artificial minds.
In your essay, you distinguish between two views of morality, the celestial view and the organic mm-hmm. view. And can you talk about those perspectives and why they come up in this conversation?
Sure, yeah. So these are terms I'm using to describe a really, really old division within moral philosophy. And so the celestial theorists are people who think that morality is absolute and objective. There is only one morality. It's out there in the world, beyond our minds. It's celestial because it's like the stars up in the sky way beyond us. And it's only one. There could only be one morality for any possible intelligent creature. The organic view is the view that morality comes out of the special nature of a particular creature. So there's a human morality, which has to do with what kind of beings humans are, being born, dying, and so forth. But it's not necessarily true that other types of beings, say intelligent robots, would have the same morality. And it really matters which of those two approaches we take. The celestial morality I haven't really talked much about yet, but the idea is that there's one correct morality out there. And if we think that's true, maybe we're going to think that we're actually not living up to it yet. Maybe we're not as good as we could be. And maybe robots, maybe the robots that are smarter than us, that think faster than we do, or maybe even that don't have the kind of hang-ups that we have from our evolutionary biological heritage, they might be better at it. So a really common example of this is controversial, but some ethicists think that we shouldn't care just about our own children. We should care about everybody's children equally. So you shouldn't prioritize just taking care of your own kids. You should worry about everybody's kids. And if that means sometimes your own kids don't get as much because you need to redistribute resources or protect other people's kids, you should do that. Now, that's very controversial. But even if it's true, we're not going to do it. Human beings are attached to our own children. We're not going to just give up our own kids. So if it's true that we should be impartial, robots will be better at doing that than we are because they won't be attached to their own children. They don't have children. Now, that's one proposal. We can discuss whether or not that's true, but it's an example of the kind of thing robots might be free. My worry about that approach is that I don't think we're going to let robots get that far ahead of us. If they start ignoring our attachment to our own children and making decisions, say when they're driving cars for us, that endanger our own children, we're just not going to let them go that far. So it's dangerous to start from the beginning thinking, right from the beginning, robots are going to be better than we are, they're going to think faster than we are, we're going to let them make all the decisions. That's also not a very good model because we're just not going to let them. We're going to shut them down if they start scaring us. So this is, again, why thinking about them like teenagers is helpful because, again, we don't hand over control to the world to 16-year-olds. We start handing them control bit by bit. And we make them explain themselves, and we go step by step, back and forth. So I think that the celestial model even if it is true that there's some objective morality out there, we're not going to use it in designing robots. We're going to need them to be closer to us than letting them run free. Maybe in the far distant future, when we've gotten used to living alongside them, they can start teaching us things they've figured out, but it's not going to work at the beginning.
How are we ever going to figure out what matters to an artificial intelligence?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I don't know if we'll ever be able to fully understand, because we're going to have some difficulty, like I suggested at the beginning. They're going to care. Maybe they care about random things like sofas. We're going to have to try to talk to them, and we won't fully be able to get into their minds. But this is actually a problem we already have, and this, again, is where the teenager model is helpful. I think many parents of teenagers say, I don't really understand what they're thinking about. Why would they do that? You can't ever get fully into somebody else's mind, even another human, even a human you're very closely related to and you love. So I think that we have to accept there's going to be limits on how much we can understand, and we just have to be willing to try. Hopefully, if things work out well, if we can develop robots that can communicate with us, we'll understand them to some degree, but we're never going to totally understand them.
You know, you said with a certain amount of confidence in your voice that if we get scared of them, we'll just shut them down. You know, there's certain, I'm a big science fiction reader. There's lots of scenarios where, oops, too late.
No, you're right.
We didn't turn them off fast enough. Now they're running the world.
No, you're totally right. And so there are people who are experts on this. There's an organization at Oxford called the Future Humanity Institute. There are other organizations that spend a lot of time thinking about this, about how to exercise safety regarding artificial intelligence. And I'm going to defer to the experts on the safety questions. They try to think about how to make sure that a very, very super intelligent AI can't just get into the computer system and take over all the nuclear weapons and do all the terrible science fiction things. And I'm going to defer to them on those kind of big questions. But I'm thinking, even if we solve those questions, even if we can put in safeguards, then we still have these remaining questions about how to deal with the circumscribed and safe AIs. How do we keep them from having lives that are artificial lives that are bad for them? And so I think that the teenager model is a way of making sure that we treat them fairly, and it's not just about us.
There's so much science fiction out there now. I'm just wondering what you've watched or read that really resonates with you as a good example of the questions that you're talking about now.
Oh, that's a really good question. Interestingly, everyone keeps telling me to watch Westworld, which I haven't seen yet. But I gather from the way people have described it that it definitely is touching on some of the same themes, some of the same themes I'm thinking about here. But any kind of story that takes the robot's perspective, I think some of Asimov's work does this, where it tries to get us to think, what would it be like to occupy this role, this artificial creation? What would it be like to interact? Actually, I think I'm probably not the first person to point this out, but Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is a good example here, thinking of Frankenstein's monster, this creation of humans that feels really sad in the end about not being treated as an equal by humans. So I'm less interested in the apocalypse version where the robots kill us all, and I'm more interested in thinking about this neglected by some people of what it's like to be that robot, and that's where I'm starting from.
Yeah, that idea of being awakened. Now, you mentioned Isaac Asimov, famous for his laws for robotics. Can you talk about those and whether or not they're still relevant?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting start. So his idea is that robots should be given these very simple laws, which are designed to make sure they don't harm humans, and they only protect themselves, and they only try to do other things if that's compatible with not harming human beings. But the problem with those laws is that you have to define harm. So we already have these disputes. I teach medical ethics, and one of the questions we have for doctors is, what counts as harm? Imagine you have a pianist who really values playing the piano, but she gets an infection in her hand, and the only way to save her life is to amputate, and she tells the doctors, no, I don't want to lose my hand. I can't live without playing. I want to play a little bit longer, and I know I'm going to die of this infection. And doctors debate, is it harmful to allow her to make that choice? Is it harmful to take her hand away? And we can't agree on that. And so if we're going to have robots helping us in medicine in the future, they have to have an understanding of what human harm means. And so Asimov's laws are incomplete without some further discussion of how to understand harm and how to understand disagreements about harm. And that's another way in which robots are going to have to be in dialogue with us rather than being programmed with firm laws at the beginning. They're going to have to learn and adapt as we do.
You know, I think about that science fiction movie. It might have been a book before Her, where the guy falls in love with his operating system, yeah. which isn't an artificial intelligence. And then eventually, yeah. no spoiler alert, is abandoned by that AI because yeah. she is more interested or he realizes she's having whatever she is, relationships with thousands of people yeah. and also thousands or whatever, uncountable numbers of other AIs out there.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kind of bored with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we're going to have to realize. If one possibility is that these artificial minds will be able to think much faster than we do, and because they might be software, they might live on the internet, they may interact with other people in ways that we can't. Like you just said, in fact, lots and lots and lots of people at the same time. And that really changes social dynamics. So we may have to be able to try to think ahead, how are we going to interact with these things that have a kind of social life that we can't have? And that's a really good example of how we might anticipate that. And it might be really hard for us. We may have to make adjustments.
Well, Regina Rini, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks so much for having me on.
That's Regina Rini. She is a philosophy professor at NYU Center for Bioethics, and she's written about this issue of growing up AI. We'll have a link to her article in Eon on our website at wosu.org/allsides. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. Facebook is the largest social network with the most active users in the world, but the social media giant is not resting on its laurels. Last week at its annual developer conference called F8, the company announced innovations and its vision for the future, including plans to expand into artificial intelligence, virtual and augmented reality, and even mind reading. BuzzFeed senior tech reporter Alex Kantorowicz covered the event. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So Facebook is working on technology that will allow users to type with their thoughts. What do we know about this so far?
Well, not enough to really say whether it's going to work or not.
Okay.
But what they've done is hire Regina Dugan, who used to run DARPA, and they said basically go out and develop some next generation hardware for us. And one of the things that they're working on doing is creating technology that'll be able to take what you're thinking and write it down.
Would this have to be technology that's sort of embedded in me?
So there's going to be some hardware for sure, but what it is still a little bit murky. I spoke with Regina Dugan, and she told me that it could come in the form of a headband with what I think is probably some wires attached mm-hmm. or embedded inside augmented reality glasses. They're still trying to figure out exactly what's going to happen, but it won't be like someone from Facebook can walk up to you and put their hand on their head like Spock would and then say, aha, I knew that you were going to use Snapchat.
But it would be like a dictation without having to talk.
Right. They say they want it to happen straight from the speech center. Now, I got some questions about that. When I try to not think about something, mm-hmm. all I can do is think about it. Mm-hmm. So if I don't want to send something to my speech center, is that going to end up getting typed out onto Facebook's platform? I think these are some questions the company's going to have to answer before they start rolling this stuff out.
Well, and yeah, exactly. All of this is in terms of Facebook, right? Still as we know it now.
Yeah, so we'll see exactly how they deal with the technology. Some of it might be to help you type into your newsfeed. Others of it might be to help you navigate through new augmented reality products that they're working on. They may release the technology out into the open. All we know right now is within 2 years they want to show that it can work, and then we'll see what happens if they can get there.
Why is this a goal of a company like Facebook?
There's a number of reasons why Facebook is trying to make this happen, but to me, the best one is that right now we're living in a world where our phones take us out of the moment. You've all had conversations where you're trying to speak with somebody that you care about, and next thing you know, their phone is consuming their entire attention. And so what I think that this could do is potentially let you handle things while living in the moment. One of the suggestions they gave is they want to develop augmented reality glasses. So imagine you were able to get some notifications in these glasses you could wear and simply with your mind tick yes or no in terms of whether you wanted to go to the movies later or pay a bill. And instead of having to pick out your phone every time it buzzes, you could start to interact with the digital world that way. So that sounds interesting to me, but I think that we still haven't heard the full set of use cases that Facebook is interested in dealing with this technology.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about prospects for Facebook in the future. It's the largest social network, most active users in the world, but they want more, more, more. Last week at its annual developer conference called F8, the company announced innovations and a vision for the future. I'm talking with Alex Kantrowitz. He is a BuzzFeed senior tech reporter who covered the event. If you have a question or comment about this, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Facebook also announced a new camera platform. What did they showcase at the conference, Alex?
Yeah, the camera platform is pretty cool. Basically, what it does is it uses artificial intelligence to seize on to objects and allow you to, from your phone, interact with the physical world. So it's an overlay of the digital world on top of the physical world. Right now, the way that that's going to manifest itself is through filters and effects, like you might see in Snapchat. So you can turn yourself into a dog, or you can turn your, like, focus the camera onto a room and turn it into a planetarium where planets hover on the ceiling and shooting stars shoot across the screen. Long term, what Facebook wants to do is make something where you could really create this digital world that overlays on top of the real world. So, for instance, what they want to do is be able to have you move your phone around your house or your office or a scene that's special to you. And they can map that out in a three-dimensional way that you can look at on your phone and see depth and look behind objects. And then long-term, you might be able to leave objects. So imagine you have a place that's really special with your kid and you're there with them and you map it out in 3D and then just leave a little video note of the two of you. So next time they want to feel like they're in the moment, they could go back to that scene and experience it again. So these are the type of things that it's looking to do in terms of augmenting reality, which is like taking digital and putting it onto the real world.
Is this sort of a virtual reality thing too?
It's something that you can view in virtual reality, but I'd really say virtual reality and augmented reality are really separate. Augmented reality is something that I would say it really needs the real world to exist. So you take your phone and you can gain more information about objects you're seeing, or you can turn the world into a game, like as what happened with Pokemon a few months ago. Virtual reality is not tied to the real world at all, so you can start living in, different planets, or experience things that just were impossible to exist inside the real world and don't have to be hinged to anything physical at all.
Now, you said that Facebook's leader on the mind reading project is Regina mm-hmm. Dugan. Facebook put their artificial intelligence team to work on the camera platform and the augmented reality part of that. What role are they playing in all that?
The AI team is really central to all of these efforts. One way to look at it is just to think about what the computer is able to process through its camera. So not long ago, a computer was really blind. You were able to take a picture, but it had no idea what was inside that picture. And through a number of advances over the past few years, computers can really see now. They use something called neural nets, which breaks down images, identifies tiny little parts, and then makes a decision about what it's seeing, similar to the way that our brain works. and it's able to process what's in a photo. So before it was just pixels, it was ones and zeros. Now it's a waterfall, it's a cat, it's members of a family, it's people playing and interacting, and eventually it will be, you know, it will be able to understand that when you take a water bottle and you tilt it, it's watching a video, you take a water bottle and you tilt it, it will be able to predict, okay, the next thing that's going to happen is the person standing underneath that water bottle is going to get wet. But that's a little ways away.
They, as far as artificial intelligence goes, last month you wrote a story about how Facebook is using artificial intelligence to help in suicide prevention. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. So what Facebook is doing is basically it's using artificial intelligence to look through its content and pick out signals for someone that, you know, may be thinking about hurting themselves. And what it does is, instead of taking action, it's not like the AI is going to pop onto your screen like in one of those movies you described in the earlier segment and say, stop. What will happen is it will flag it to Facebook's community monitors and saying, hey, I'm seeing something here that you might want to take a look at. And one of the most fascinating things about Facebook's artificial intelligence in action in this scenario is that it's more accurate in flagging potentially troubling content to its content moderators than humans are. So when Facebook's AI will flag something, it's more likely humans will take action and end up sending more resources to people who they think might be in harm's way.
You know, more recently we've had the case of the guy who killed somebody, kind of executed somebody on Facebook Live. Is that something that could be, you know, could we be alerted to stuff like that by way of this?
Absolutely. I think that if Facebook is going to start to handle some of these really troubling content that's appearing on Facebook Live, AI is something they have to be thinking about. Like we said earlier, AI is something that takes a computer from being completely blind to something that can see, which means it can identify images and sort of start to make determinations about them. And that means that AI can look through Facebook's, you know, billions of photos and determine when there's a gun in it. And you know, it's not such a far stretch to imagine a day where Facebook can look through the photos and videos and say, okay, there's a gun shooting, and maybe potentially bring it to its content moderation team. Now, it sounds easy. When you think about it in these terms, it's actually a really difficult problem to solve with a tremendous amount of privacy implications. Do we really want Facebook's
AI? Next question, right.
You know, going through all of our photos, do we really want it going through all of our videos? So Facebook's kind of unleashed this Pandora's box by creating the Live product. I don't know if they thought through all the implications, but now that it's there, they're going to have to think of some creative ways to deal with it.
Well, I mean, Facebook already can go through all of our content on Facebook.
That's right. They can go through all of it, and the question is, you know, do we want them to, and to what extent, and what do we want them to be looking for? You know, these are some serious privacy issues that I think don't get enough attention, and should be thought about pretty significantly before calling the platform to action.
Right, and also there's the issue of, will Facebook want to take responsibility for it?
The answer to that is no.
Right.
It usually only takes responsibility when it's forced to. But give the platform credit. It's like in a position, of course it needs the public's goodwill, but it's also in a position where it's the only show in town in terms of being able, like, you know, the level of connections that it's able to make. 1.8 billion users, as you noted, biggest social platform in the world. And people always say, I can't deal with Facebook anymore, I have to quit Facebook. But how often do you see them follow through with that? It's become this necessity for a lot of people. So that puts Facebook in a very powerful position. And we've seen the good intent Facebook. I don't know if we'd want to see a Facebook with less positive intentions.
You also recently wrote a lengthy profile of Facebook's head AI researcher, Jan Lacan. What are some of the things you learned from him about the future of AI?
It can be really interesting and something that would be really at odds with a lot of people's perceptions of what an AI future might lead to. One of the things that he mentioned was like Facebook has interest in creating virtual assistants that will coordinate with your friend's virtual assistants. So imagine this scenario. You and your friend say, we'd like to go see a movie, and your AI virtual assistant checks with them, compares calendars, interests in movies, and looks at the showtime and finds something that's compatible and that when you'll both be in town, and then asks you both if you want to book it. Like, this is Facebook's long-term vision, or one of the pieces of its long-term vision in AI. So, is that technology something that could also be used for bad ends? Probably. But the way that he paints the picture is a pretty positive way.
Mm-hmm. Finally, at last week's conference, Facebook announced a new virtual reality app called Facebook Spaces. Is that something that you've talked about?
Yes, and I actually tried it out last week.
Oh, yeah?
Before I go into the comment, I just want to preface by saying I've always thought VR is pretty dumb. It seemed to me like it's like captured by the picture of the dude on the subway who's wearing the VR goggles.
Right.
And he doesn't want to experience the real world, and I think the real world has a lot to offer. That said, Facebook Spaces is pretty cool. It's something that will create a virtual reality avatar for you. One that moves when you move and can start to mimic your hand motions again in this world that's not hinged to reality. And the cool thing that Facebook wants to do is put you in a space with other avatars. So, for instance, I live in San Francisco, and if I gave one of the sets, so like a headset, to my family in New York, what this thing could do is put us in the same space. So we would be standing around a table, and we would all have our avatars, and it would feel like we're in the same room, and then you can start going through family photos or looking at videos. And it's I went into this experience with somebody in a completely different room at Facebook's conference, and it was pretty interesting. It felt like there was real presence there, like we were standing right next to each other. So I don't think that technology is going to be something that's going to go mass-produced within the next year or two, mm-hmm. but it's definitely something that has potential and is worth paying attention to.
It always cracks me up when I talk to tech journalists who say, I don't think it's going to happen in the next year or two. And in my mind, I'm thinking in the next 100 yeah. years or two.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about this, the period we're living in is time frames are super difficult to predict. You know, a few years ago, it seemed like self-driving cars were 100, 200 years away.
Right.
And the pace of the technology has been that we're now seeing them drive around Pittsburgh. So, you know, I think that the appropriate hedge for a tech reporter to take today is kind of a difficult line to land on.
Yeah.
Because we always want to approach something, these things, with skepticism and caution. But on the other hand, the technology is in many ways proving itself to be moving fast with the level of processing power we have today and the amount of time people have spent on these problems. So it's a difficult problem to predict, but we've been surprised more than once.
Are you, just from where you sit, Alex Kantorowicz, are you confident that we're going to be ready for all of this?
I'm not at all. I think that this whole wave brings a level of problems that we haven't seen before. It's starting to really have some serious implications for the labor force. What happens when trucks drive themselves? That's a lot of jobs that are at risk. What happens when cars drive themselves? You know, more jobs. We're already seeing the automation in industry, which is, again, like one of the interesting things after this big announcement, the president saved all those jobs at the Carrier plant.
Mm-hmm.
Carrier went out and said, we're going to look to automate a lot of these with technology. So this is a new, fascinating, and also sometimes terrifying world for a lot of people. And the more we ask questions about how it's going to impact our real lives and our economy and our jobs, is will make us better prepared. But unfortunately, I don't think we ask enough of those today.
Well, thank you for talking about it with me. I appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
Alex Kantorowicz, senior tech reporter for BuzzFeed.com. Coming up, Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last month, Nintendo's latest gaming console, the Nintendo Switch, was released along with a game in the Legends of Zelda series. Now another classic game is available for Switch users. Mario, Luigi, and the whole gang of characters from the Mario Brothers universe are back on the racetrack with Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks.
So for all the non-gamers out there, can you explain what Mario Kart is and why this new release is such a big, hairy deal?
Well, it was originally created at a time where, racing games were this, kind of big, serious thing where, everything was focused on how realistic the graphics were and how real the cars looked, and, how fancy the cars were. And Mario Kart, in what is now kind of a standard Nintendo fashion, kind of thumbed their nose at that and just made something that was really silly. It took the kind of animated characters from all of Nintendo's games, stuck them in, what looked like go-karts or, sometimes things that were more like shopping carts or even, something smaller, and put them on a racetrack where the objective was to win, but in the process of winning, you were also collecting all kinds of silly accessories in order to trip up the other people that were racing. So it was more, it was almost like a fight against the other people, to slow them down so much as, speed yourself up.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Russell Holley, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. We're talking about the new Nintendo Mario Kart game and why it's such a big deal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you could email us at allsides@wosu.org. Russell Holley, are you there?
Yep.
Okay. So Mario Kart 8 was previously released on Nintendo's Wii U console. What's new in this version?
They've done a lot in the way of changing the gameplay so that you don't have to kind of work to unlock individual characters. Instead, you're going to start off and have access to all of the characters that you would expect to have in this game. There's also going to be some mechanics changes to how you're going to be able to play. You're not going to, when you go around corners, there's this, kind of drift mechanic that allows you to go faster and you go through this turn, and that's changed from the version that was released on the Wii U. And so there's been, kind of a lot of small changes, and they all kind of add up to what surprisingly feels like a different game in most cases.
And they've praised the game's upgraded battle mode. Is that what you were talking about as far as collecting all those objects along the way to trip up?
Well, so battle mode just kind of removes the racing component altogether and puts you in an arena where you're just using those items to trip people up. Whereas in the normal race mode, you're using that to kind of give yourself an advantage in the race so that you can win first. But the battle mode just kind of removes that pretense and focuses it all on throwing things like, turtle shells and stuff at one another.
And how is Nintendo Switch doing, do you think? Is it too early to talk about, or what do you make of it?
It's been a tremendous launch so far for Nintendo. The last set of metrics that were released indicated that it was the second largest release in gaming history dating back to 1995. As far as console launches go, it's significantly larger than the last Xbox, the last PlayStation, and most certainly the last couple of things that Nintendo has released.
Okay, we're going to try calling Russell Holley back right now. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment about technology for Russell Holley, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We've been talking about Mario Kart, new release of Mario Kart, Mario Kart 8, what's good, the bad, and the ugly about it. Apparently nothing much ugly about it, according to Russell Holley. So last week we ran out of time before we could talk about a new crowdfunding service that guarantees successful delivery of products. And last week one of those ventures folded, leaving its backers with nothing. We're going to talk to Russell Holley about that right now. If you have a question or a comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Russell Holley, you're back, right?
I hope so.
Yay. Oh, my gosh. What a switch. Whew. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the company called Plastiq. They raised millions in pre-orders for their smart credit card product. What happened?
Well, it turned out that the thing that they wanted to make was a lot more complicated than what they were intending to deliver initially. And the credit card technology in the U.S. Changed in the process of creating this thing that they wanted. So the idea that they had by the time they were ready to deliver that idea from their Kickstarter campaign, it turned out they had to completely change everything in order to make this new kind of credit card, and they just ran out of money.
How would it have worked?
The idea here, and this was not new at the time, although weirdly all three of the companies that were proposing similar ideas have all failed now. The idea was to have a single card that contained multiple cards that you could conveniently switch back and forth. So you had this one card that sat like in a wallet or maybe in a phone case or something, and you could intelligently switch back and forth between the cards that you wanted to use in this card. It was really simple, and it was secured by your phone. If the card was more than a certain distance from your phone, the card would simply not work. And then when it was brought back closer to your phone, you could then unlock it and use it again. So it was offering this kind of new way to, secure and simplify wallets. But in the process of making this work, the United States switched over largely to, the chip reader system, which was not originally a part of Plastiq's design.
Okay.
And accounting for that turned out to be really expensive.
So that was the reason then, the ultimate reason why it was so hard to pull it off?
They ran into a lot of different manufacturing problems initially, and when they sorted those out, they had to then accommodate this new chip system because it was becoming a default option in the U.S. And really, by the end of this year, is going to be the predominant way that people pay for things in the U.S. And so they had to switch to do that. And they released several prototypes that were supposed to work well enough, but it was never as successful as they wanted it to be. And then very recently they announced that they had just kind of run out of money. And so unfortunately the $9 million worth of pre-order backers, basically people who had kind of invested in this idea, have nothing to show for it now.
There's a new crowdfunding site that was developed to avoid these kinds of losses. It's called Fit for Launch. What does it do differently?
So Fit for Launch is designed to, kind of enforce a guarantee of some kind on the person creating the idea and pitching the idea to people who would then invest in it. Basically it was an insurance policy that Fit for Life was offering where, users who were using that service to back projects could either expect a return in their investment if a project failed, or kind of a guarantee on a delivery on that idea.
What kind of projects? I mean, does it change the kinds of projects that can get funded that way?
It does in a little bit because each one of the projects are then kind of vetted by Fit for Launch before they make it to the site. And Fit for Launch is created by companies that have a lot of success doing crowdfunding projects. So they're very familiar with the process and the limitations and, having a business plan that actually fits that idea when moving, before they're asking people for money. And so the idea is that you would use something like Fit for Launch if you were interested in participating in something very early, but you still wanted some kind of guarantee because, unfortunately, we've reached a point now with crowdfunding services like Kickstarter and Indiegogo where it's really hard to run into someone who has used the service that doesn't have some kind of bad story following having used it. And unfortunately, you then run into people like me that, just don't learn their lesson, that have several bad stories because they keep seeing something and go, hey, that might be cool, without really thinking about how it would end up being delivered.
I've never done I've done crowdfunding, but I've never done anything like with a device or a thing that I'd get some kind of, I'm supposed to benefit from it somehow. What have you done that has worked, in your opinion?
I found a lot of really great success with art. There have been comic book artists who, they only do publishing on the web. And so they say, hey, I want to take this and turn it into a book, for everyone to pre-order. But I'd really like to have the money up front before I go and do that. And so they end up kind of using Kickstarter as a crowdfunding thing. There have been artists that I have met in person that have done some incredible photography books that kind of have this idea, but the idea of funding it in such a way that they can produce a book that they're really happy with ends up being prohibitively expensive. And so Kickstarter in many of those cases ends up almost being used as a pre-order system. The benefit in many of those situations being that the artist can then turn around and say, if we make a certain amount more than I had originally hoped, then these extra things will be added on top for kind of incentive to tell your friends to participate in this thing. And so I have now five or six actual bound books and several comic books that I found that are just really wonderful things that I wouldn't have owned without something like Kickstarter existing.
So, but anything sort of speculative then is the tough stuff. It's where we think we're going to come up with this great idea and we're going to create this item, but we're not sure we can do it.
Yeah, the idea behind most of the technology based Kickstarters ends up being very complicated to deliver on. Unless the company already has a functioning prototype by the time they're asking you for money,
mm-hmm.
It's kind of a really solid indicator for me anyway. Now, if I look at a Kickstarter and I say, man, that video was really well produced, let's see what they have so far, and they haven't even built a functioning prototype yet, it's usually a solid indicator that either it's not going to show up quite the way that anyone had hoped, or it's not going to show up at all. And in a lot of cases, unfortunately, I end up being right.
But you do it anyway.
I do, because they're so neat. Like, the idea is so cool, and if it works, then I'd be really happy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you want to support innovation, right?
That's right.
Samsung's new flagship phone, the Galaxy S8, has gotten pretty good reviews, but one sticking point is a new button on the phone. It's called the Bixby button. What is it?
So Samsung launched a service called Bixby, which is designed to compete with Siri and Microsoft's Cortana and Google's Now service, and in a way, Amazon's Alexa, but kind of at a later date, as this kind of separate thing that did a whole bunch of different important things. The Bixby is tied into Samsung's camera, where it can translate things from many different languages in real time to other languages. So that you just hold up your camera, and if you see, a sign that is in another language, it'll translate it right there, and that part works really well. And it has a kind of an aggregate feed on the phone that pulls together all of your calendar information and your social networks and stuff. So you have this kind of simple, easy feed to go through. But the whole idea of a voice assistant, similar to how Siri and Google Now would work, but also tied into all of these other things in this kind of new, unique way. Doesn't quite work yet. And so you have this button on the side of the Galaxy S8 that is, they call it the Bixby button, and it is designed to launch this Bixby service. And right now it really just doesn't do much because the voice component to this hasn't been enabled yet. And the camera part is, built into the camera app. So you activate it through a separate, mode. And so it's almost like having a button that takes you to like an RSS reader or Facebook or something like that, where, you didn't really need a physical button for it. And there's this promise that more is going to happen with it later. But in the meantime, users don't really have the ability to change what this button is capable of. So you run into people like me who hit the button accidentally a couple times a day now and launch this thing that doesn't quite work as advertised yet.
I was going to say, then just don't use the button, but...
Butterfingers. Yeah, right, the volume down button.
Right. Okay.
On the phone. So I bump into it, two or three times a day.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, Russell Holly, thanks as always for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor at AndroidCentral.com. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, assistant producer Shia Lanat, All Sides interns Sarah Stacy, Kyle McKinnon, and Emily Sink, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.